Welcome to part two of Evolutionary Psychology. I'm Donovan Bigelow. And having laid down the basics, the basic theoretical proponents of evolutionary psychology in lecture one, now we're going to get into the fun stuff. What women want, what men want. Remember the quote from the first lecture from Freud? I have worked for 40 years trying to understand the human mind, and the one question that still eludes me is, what women want? Which I just thought was hilarious. But now evolutionary psychologists have given us some answers, and they've given us answers based on cross-cultural research. There does appear to be a series of priorities that do not depend on learning, do not depend on culture, ethnicity, religious affiliation, that there does appear to be decent scientific research that suggests a series of things that women want that appear to be universal. Now, the first thing that we notice is that women apparently want approximately 10 individual things, individual attributes in their men. Men want three. Men's calculation is simpler. Women's is immensely complex. And I think everyone sort of intuitively gets that. The evolutionary psychologists are explaining why that is. And it goes back, of course, to biology. Women exercise a greater discretion than men. Most of us sort of intuitively get that a woman, by and large, will exercise discretion more rigorously than a man, that a man's standards on who he will mate with seem relatively lower than those of a woman, especially, I think we might say, on Saturday night. But the point here is why? And the answer is a pregnant woman, throughout virtually the entire course of human history, is a vulnerable creature, dramatically vulnerable, to the point where a female in the Cro-Magnon era, if she mated poorly, if she chose poorly, if she was indiscreet, if she mated with someone who could not help her, could not protect her, could not defend her, feed her, protect her from the elements, other tribes, animals, and everything else, she died. So that the simple and direct result is that women who did not have a variation in their intellectual, emotional predispositions, a predisposition to be discreet, to exercise discretion in their sexual partnering, those died off. And so over the course of evolutionary time, what we have is that virtually every woman on this planet now is an ancestor of those very, very careful, picky, choosy women. This frustrates most men, but it appears to be universally valid. And it makes sense. It makes perfect sense if you recognize that it was an evolutionary variation in the context of mating choices that had almost immediate deadly consequences. We're in a civilization now where the consequences of a bad choice of mate appear to be minimal. Turns out they're not minimal. They're still quite serious, but certainly they're not immediately deadly. And so, what were the consequences for a man back 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 years ago? What was the downside to picking poorly genetically? And the answer is not very much at all. A woman picks poorly and she dies. A man picks poorly and he loses 20 or 30 minutes. So, absolutely unfair, but the unfairness of it is about the biological ramifications of pregnancy throughout most of our history. One other sort of biological fact that always strikes students a little funny is the question of how many children can a woman have? And the answer seems obvious. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. There's a few examples of 12, 13, 14, 15, but that's usually in groups of triplets and twins. What's clear is that a woman in her productive years cannot have very many children. Therefore, if she doesn't pick well, she loses genetically. How many children can a man have? One of my favorite examples is apparently there's a king in a South African province. I don't remember the name of it. He's apparently biologically related to a third of the people in his little kingdom. He's got 600 wives, several thousand children, 300 or 400 concubines. It's good to be king. But the point is, it's limited almost solely by the amount of money you have or the power that you have. The biological fact is simple. Women have 400 eggs in their ova when they're born. The female's ova are completely formed prenatally. Men generate, once they reach adolescence, consistently 12 billion sperm an hour. Let me check that. 12 million sperm an hour. That's still a lot of sperm. 400 eggs, 400 ova for the woman, 12 million sperm an hour throughout man's virtual entire life. It's an astonishing statistical variation, and it says something about why women are more discretionary than men in their mating choices. Let me talk about kind of a sensitive subject here, the female orgasm. Researchers have actually researched this subject, and this is research that I was never involved in, unfortunately. It sounds like it would be a hoot. But the question becomes, from the perspective of evolutionary psychology, what's the purpose of the male orgasm? And that's obvious, to deliver the semen to the egg to maximize genetic survival. Quite simple, quite straightforward. Of course it feels good. Anybody who sex didn't feel good to obviously didn't mate as well, therefore is no longer in the gene pool. We are the ancestors of those who really, really, really liked sex and really enjoyed it. For men, it's a simple calculation. But what for women? What exactly is the elusive female orgasm? Researchers seem to suggest, having wired up women to look at muscular contractions in the uterus and elsewhere, the simple idea that an orgasm in a woman is an unconscious biological reaction to a superior man, that the muscular contractions of the orgasm actually proceed in a wave-like way that seems directly to have the effect of retention of semen and the movement and the assistance of the uterus, bringing that semen closer to the ova, increasing the likelihood of a fertilized egg. It's an astonishing fact that orgasms appear to be a relational dynamic, the approval of a woman to her mate choice. It suggests, now we have to be careful here because individuals are not statistical populations and there's plenty of exceptions to this rule, but the idea at least gives men something to work toward. The idea here, again, talking about only large populations, leaving plenty of room for exceptions, that a man who can bring his partner to consistent orgasmic experiences has some confidence that she at least thinks she's picked the right guy. I don't think we need to go any farther down this road. It's just one of the examples of evolutionary psychology opening up domains of research that no one had ever gone down before very far or very well. And at least, at very least, I think this is what it does. It opens up a dialogue. It opens up the possibility of taking what we all know to be sort of common experiences and giving them a depth of meaning that perhaps they didn't have before. And if it's true, or to the extent it's true, it's a fact we need to understand. A fact, if it's a fact, without which we are less adaptive. All right, so let's get to the details. What women want. We'll talk about what men want a little bit later. A caveat. There obviously should be several caveats here. But the first is, these are universal. This is what the research shows. Now, you may not like it. You may not agree with it. You don't have to like it. And you don't have to agree with it. I challenge you, though, to look at it from the perspective of population. The fact that you don't want one of these things or want something else isn't an attack on evolutionary psychology. If there's something in this list that was left out, then there's room for the theory to change. And the first caveat that Dr. Buss points out is that though this list is numbered 1 to 10, they're not in numerical order necessarily. That any woman, given her particular circumstances, will calculate these things differently. The way individual circumstances and future potential cause differential weight to be assigned to the preferences. That means you mix and match these depending on a woman's particular situation, particular culture, age, wealth, all the rest of these things. But he's going to maintain that these are all in there somewhere. And let's see if you think so. The number one thing is economic capacity. Now, this is perhaps the exception to the rule already. Buss and his colleagues have taken the position gently. They haven't been dogmatic about it, but the research seems to suggest that the number one priority for women in a relationship is a man with resources. Bling, bling. Why do men buy more expensive cars than they can afford? Why do they buy more jewelry and more expensive watches than they can afford? It appears that it is a signal to the woman of their resource acquisitions. This seems consistent over time and culture. Are the economic resources, from the woman's perspective, looking at the man, does he have the ability to accrue resources? Can he defend the resources that he accrues? Can he control them? Can he give them to her? Will he? Is he willing to? But first, you've got to have economic resources, and that seems to be the universal prerequisite for females' mate choice in men. Now, again, runs counter to our value system. It might even be seen as a bit insulting, as if women are just gold diggers. That phrase came up in the 60s. And again, don't know if it's true or not, but it does seem to explain human behavior quite well. Number two, social status. Again, common sense. Who does the high school head cheerleader end up dating most of the time? The quarterback of the football team. It seems inevitable. High status males are always the targets of superior females' attention. It's never been otherwise. It isn't equal. There is no egalitarianism in the mating competition. The best men seem to get the best woman, and social status is a cue to women. It's a cue to the acquisition of resources. Powerful men always have the ability to accrue resources. Money and power always go together. The old Secretary of State in the Nixon era and Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, someone who was reputed to be doing a fair amount of fooling around in capitals all over the world, I've heard, he said at one point, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. What he meant by that, I think, is that men with power have women throw themselves at them all the time, and apparently enough women threw themselves at him for him to notice this sort of thing. This is distressing somewhat because it reflects a tribal hierarchy that I think we protest against now, but we inevitably recognize everywhere around us. We are not egalitarian creatures. We are creatures who in tribal communities evolved hierarchies. There's always the alpha male. There's always the alpha wolf, alpha female as well, and everybody else down below. It seems like common sense in most cases, but the evolutionary psychology insight is that this has a direct and immediate effect on women's mate choices. So, men in the audience, what I'm suggesting is that all of these things give you some insight into how to present yourself, how to present your apartment, how to present your career choices, how to present your interests. So, but before I go much farther down that road, let me add as an aside one thing that's very, very important to the men out there. Evolutionary psychology, evolution, has also given women a more intuitive sense of deception. Women know men are lying much better than men can lie most of the time. So, men, as you're listening to this list of what women want, what you cannot do successfully is pretend you have these things when you don't. You may craft your life so that you can put your best foot forward. That's different. Think about it evolutionarily speaking. What were men doing for most of recorded human history? They were out hunting, defending the territory. How much did you have to communicate to hunt a buffalo? You made eye signals, you signaled, and you attacked the buffalo and you brought him back after cutting him up into pieces and parts. Not that complicated. Doesn't require a lot of intuitive, emotional communication. What were the women doing? They were all back by the fire. They were gathering. They were tending to the children around the campfire. They were talking. Women, developmentally, mature faster than men today. That's a fact. Nobody disputes that. Women's emotional intuitive capabilities, women's language capabilities, develop faster than young men's. Everybody knows that. Why? It appears that what men needed to survive in the Cro-Magnon era and before were these hunting skills, these territorial defending skills, these martial skills. They did not particularly need intuition in the relational dynamics between themselves. If they had a problem, they tended to fight, and that solved the problem. Women back in the campfire had to form coalitions, had to figure out how to create alliances, relationships. That increased their survival. That enhanced their chances of succeeding genetically. Alliances. That required an empathy. That required an intuition. That required communication skills, which men didn't need. And lo and behold, over the course of evolutionary time, we have women who are better at this, a skill that was necessary for their genetic survival. And now the differences between the genders in this issue is the source of endless comedians' jokes. But it makes sense seen from genetic survival. The point here is, guys, as you're taking notes on what women want and trying to put your best foot forward, please keep in mind that most of the time, if you're lying, she knows it. If she doesn't know it, it's because she doesn't want to know it, and that becomes a question of psychopathology, which we'll get to later. Intuition is dramatically more refined in the woman than the man. That's just a genetic difference that's true. As a psychotherapist, it makes it difficult for me sometimes. I have to work harder to be equal to a female psychologist. If I'm trying to sense my patient's difficulties, their struggles, it's harder for me to do that. It takes more training. It takes more of my own therapy experience. It takes more research on my part. It takes more effort. So there are some women who would think this is sort of payback, but the gender differences appear to be confirmed by most of the modern research, both in evolution and in the cognitive behaviorist sciences. And it's a warning to the guys listening to this not to assume just because you've got your checklist out here that it's going to do you very much good at all. All right, economic capacity, number one. Social status, number two. Number three, age. It is also universal that women want a man 2, 3, 4, 5 years older. It varies culture to culture. Some cultures want women want men 4, 5, 6 years older. In America, it's generally 2.5 years, give or take. Why? Why do women generally hang out with men slightly older? And the joke here, and it's not a joke for 9th or 10th grade boys, the loneliest place on the planet is a 9th or 10th grade boy, because the women in high school in his peer group are always dating the seniors, and the only women available are either down in junior high school, which can't be done or accessed or is illegal. And so it's lonely to be a 9th or 10th grade boy these days. Why do women prefer men older? The first answer is obvious: maturing. Biologically, women mature quicker than men, and they want someone at least on their level. More importantly, it appears, to date an older man is to have a better picture of his resume, of his potential for the acquisition of resources. Every lady understands this. Do you want to date the guy on his way to a pre-med program in college? Or do you want to date the sophomore who's still figuring out whether he wants to work at McDonald's or Burger King and not much beyond that? The answer is obvious. The explanation is in evolutionary psychology. It has to do with resume building. It has to do with maturity, stability, reliability. That's true, too. But I think mainly it has to do with a clearer status picture. There's a downside. Older, but not too old. Most women will not date a man significantly older than them unless there are definite reasons in a particular place and time to do so. Again, this is an example of the exception more or less proving the rule. Everyone's aware of the stories in Hollywood and elsewhere where a very old man will marry a very young woman. if ever there was an example of resources being the priority, those cases prove it beyond much doubt at all. The downside to those unions are that there's very often a complete lack of compatibility, that they don't speak the same cultural language, they don't listen to the same music, they don't watch the same movies, they don't read the same books. So there's some tension involved if the age difference is too extreme. But again, both of these things can be true. And in the question of age, that seems to be a clear balance that women have. They want them older, but not too much older. Number four, ambition, industriousness, and hard work. Sort of variations on a theme. Ladies, you look for men that work hard. And sheer hard work is probably the best indicator ever of the potential for the acquisition of resources. And the other side of that is women's disdain, rather harsh disdain, for the unemployed man. I've asked women in class all the time, assuming you're in a committed monogamous relationship and your man loses his job, how much time do you give him before you trade up, before he moves from the couch to the street, before you kick him to the curb? And the answers have shocked me. I have women who will say 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 1 month. I had one woman say two months, and most of the other women in the class were shocked that she would be so generous. If you ask the question directly and honestly, it appears that most women understand number four very, very well. They will not tolerate a slacker. Ambition, industriousness, and hard work are critical to most women's mating choices. What about the women who pick the slacker? That leaves us in the category of psychopathology to be discussed at a later lecture. Number five, dependability and stability. This is second only to love, which is the last thing. Dependability and stability. It doesn't do any good if a man's got all the resources in the world if he doesn't bring them home to you all the time, if he can't be trusted, if he isn't stable. The idea of dependability and stability is the woman's clue to long-term resource availability. He's got to have resources, but he's got to be willing over the long run to bring them home to that woman, or she risks genetic death, quite literally. So let's take this as an example. Guys, you're going out on a date? What do you talk about? Do you talk about your career? Do you talk about the Seahawks? Do you talk about football? Do you talk about baseball, basketball? Do you talk about the latest comic book you have? What do you talk about? Do you talk about your career track, what you're learning in school, your ambitions, what you want in life, a house, a car, a picket fence, 2.4 children, and a retirement fund? What are you talking about? Show her your ambition. Show her your dependability and stability. You know, if the last five relationships that you've had ended in 911 calls, maybe that's not the right thing to tell her right off the bat. And maybe you need to see a therapist if that's the case, because you're doing something rather inefficient. So ambition goes along with dependability and stability as second only to love. Number six, intelligence. Now, this one's obvious. It should be. But it's also inheritable. What most researchers suggest is that 60 to 80% of intelligence is inheritable. So you want a smart guy, ladies, it seems clear, but you want them for a lot of reasons. Number one, most obvious, a smart man is more likely to bring home the bacon, more likely to amass resources than one less gifted intellectually. But it's also more likely that if you marry a smarter man, you will have smarter children, and that ensures genetic survival as well. A smarter man may have better parenting skills, will have better problem-solving skills, will exercise better judgment, frankly, is likely to be of a higher status. The only complication is you want one about at your level or as high as you can get and still be compatible. So people who hook up with someone who is either dramatically smarter or less smart than they are end up with compatibility issues that threaten the relationship. So somewhere in the zone. But intelligence is always going to be a factor. Guys, what magazines are on your table at home? What books are on your shelf? You have to put, you can't pretend you're smarter than you are, but you ought to be able to put your best foot forward, because these things aren't pinpoints, they're spectrums, and you can push yourself, at least appearance-wise, to the maximum potential that you have. Number 7, compatibility. This seems also, common sense seems obvious. If you're compatible with someone, you are minimizing the chance of a breakup. The more compatible you are, the more likely you're to stay together. What that means is you're more likely to be able to effectively raise children together and have them be effective parents, and thereby ensuring your genetic survival. The lack of compatibility generates conflict. Compatibility really, in some ways, is emotional bonding, or at least facilitates identification with each other. Call it emotional bonding. And that, again, reinforces the likelihood of the protection of the children. The next one's interesting, number 8, size and strength. Now, throughout all of evolutionary time, this one was obvious. A bigger, stronger man was likely to be a better hunter, defender of the territory. What about today? Is that true? No. Does that matter? Apparently not to most women. One of the several of the research results from Dr. Buss was that women prefer taller, stronger men, all other things being equal. And it seems like one of those predispositions we talked about, one of those biologically based predispositions, tendencies, preferences that seems hardwired in women. It may have started as a preference that reflected directly on the woman's physical survival and that of her children, but it remains powerful in the modern culture where that sort of thing is much less likely to be immediately necessary. We do have 911. We do have guns. And the old joke was that God did not make men equal, Mr. Colt did. And women now have access to as many firearms as men do. So the tendency for women to prefer bigger, stronger men remains, I think, interesting and explained by this theory. Now, guys, what does that mean? What happens if you're not big and strong? Are you out of the mating pool? Well, no, of course not. The component here that I think is sophisticated is willingness, will. Even a big, strong man might be a coward and therefore unappealable or unappealing to a woman. Does your woman, men, looking you right in the eye now, does your woman know in her heart of hearts that if a bad guy comes out of the alleyway at her, you're going to stand in front of her, between her and him, and you're going to throw down? And if he gets to her, it's only going to be over your broken, bleeding body. If your woman knows that, you're the man. And it doesn't matter how tall, how short you are. It's willingness to defend and protect that makes such an importance now. And technology now literally makes men equal. And frankly, if you have some skill with weapons, you are any man's superior on the question of defending your woman. So there's also been research in the military that size, tallness, has always been associated with higher status. General officers that make the rank of general, not surprisingly, are all significantly taller than most of the rest of the soldiers and other officers that get passed over for promotion. It's almost funny. You've got to be a very tall man to be a general officer most of the time in the American military. This is one of those facts that seem to prove something's going on in evolutionary psychology. Let me tell you a quick story here that sort of reinforces this. Two stories, actually. The first is 15 years ago or so, I was walking along Lake Washington. The woman I was walking with was a very powerful woman. She was a senior clinician in the field. She was a psychotherapist. She was wealthy. She was quite attractive. She drove a BMW and owned her own home, was kind of at the top of her game clinically, well-respected in the field, basically as powerful as you can get. We were walking along the water, and just in front of us, over the lip of the little retaining wall, a muskrat jumped out and hit the water. A muskrat is a large rat-looking thing with a long tail. And it scared her, and she instantly jumped behind me, took hold of my arm, and it was the fastest movement I'd seen in a long time. And I wanted to joke. I wanted to say, "Well, don't you worry, little lady. I'll defend you against that vicious monster." It was a little muskrat, and it had jumped away. And this woman, so powerful, so intelligent, so at the peak of her game culturally, her instinctive reaction, without thinking, was to jump behind the big, strong guy. It's just an anecdote. It's just an anecdote. But it seemed, as I read the evolutionary material, sort of interesting. Second story. When I was a student in Germany, I was an exchange student at the University of Bonn. At the time, I was a martial artist, and I was training very seriously in full contact martial arts. There was a woman in another martial arts club in the same building. We were both 19, 20 years old at the time. And she was training in another club, and she was a very good fighter. I could see her. She was 5'10", strong, healthy build. Could do 200 push-ups on her knuckles. Amazing fighter. And we were walking one day, the two of us, in a bad part of town because we were broke students and that's the only place we could live. And there were five men that were walking at us, and they appeared to be from Turkey. At that point, this was in the 1975 or 6, there were immigrant populations in Germany of Turks that were... they were not assimilating particularly well, and it was a bit of a social problem for everyone. And frankly, these five looked like they were going to be trouble. They were talking loudly, pointing. They might have been drinking. It's not clear. But they were pointing at her and saying things in Turkish that seemed quite dangerous, at least the tone of their voice and what they were looking at. And there was no one else around, and we were in some trouble, it looked like to me. And I said to her, as we walked, there was nowhere else to go. We had to keep walking, and I didn't think it would be appropriate to run or show fear. I whispered to her, "You take the two on the left, I'll take the three on the right." And she said, "Okay." And I was actually kind of excited because my thought was, okay, if this goes bad, I got to take out those three guys really quickly because I really want to watch her take out those other two. I had full confidence that she could. And later, in studying Dr. Buss's writings, it occurred to me that, wow, technology and our culture is so different than our Cro-Magnon ancestors, is providing opportunities for men and women to take the prerequisites, to take the predispositions that biology has given us, that evolution has given us, and take them in all kinds of creative ways. So I think what I tell you these silly stories, in part, to open up possibilities, to think differently about your place, whether you're a man or a woman. If you recognize that you've got these predispositions, it gives you the possibility of doing something about them that might be meaningful, facilitating your strengths, compensating for weaknesses, and overall, dramatically increasing the chances of your genetic success. Number 9, good health. Again, it seems obvious, but the genetic implications are important. Good health, what does that mean? Symmetrical features, clear skin, full lips, lustrous hair, a strong physique, healthy physique, not given to disease or parasites or anything like that. Symmetrical features often are assumed to be, in the textbooks on evolutionary psychology, they show Denzel Washington as a person with perfectly attractive symmetrical features. And then they show Lyle Lovett, the singer, who's got kind of a face that's at a bit of an angle. And he's not so attractive from just this perspective. So the assumption is that health is inheritable, a little like intelligence. If you marry someone who's robust physically, capable of enduring illness, you're much more likely to pass that important characteristic or combination of characteristics onto your children. In addition, a healthy mate is much more likely to be around in the long term to provide for the children and you. And remember, we're talking from a woman's perspective now. So, guys, what's the answer? Do you smoke? You're done. Do you drink too much? You're done. Do you do other things you shouldn't do? You need to stop them. Do you need to get to the gym? Are you overweight? Are you underweight? The good health and the way you take care of yourself is a key discriminator in how women perceive you as a potential mate. This one is one you have a great deal of power over, it seems to me. So the combination of things, lowering the risk of death by a lifestyle that's healthy, the ability to pass on genetically a robust physique to the children, increasing their chances of genetic survival, and the fact that you're likely on a day-to-day basis to be a more capable resource provider and a more capable present partner. Wow, this one's easy. Get to the gym. Number 10, love and commitment. And I bet most of you were waiting for this one. This one probably should have been number one. And it's number 10 doesn't mean it's way down on the list of priorities. I think everybody gets, and Dr. Buss understood perfectly, that love and commitment was central to a woman's choice. How does a man show his love? This is where it's tied together. Why do we buy wedding rings? An act of love, which symbolizes the acquisition of resources, the retention of resources, and the ability to acquire new and more resources in the future. It isn't an accident that the wedding ring companies suggest a certain minimum monthly, I've heard the ads on television or radio, the monthly percentage of your income going to the ring to make sure it's the minimum that she'll like. I think there's something right about that. I think there is a certain preference that women have for these kind of demonstrations of love, which seem to not coincidentally always involve gifts. Also, love, I think, reflects from the woman's perspective the promise of fidelity. If you love her, if she gets that you love her, you are much more likely to be loyal and present and committed. And that is perhaps the only guarantee of ensuring genetic survival. What does kindness and sincerity, what does emotional support mean practically? Because the evolutionary psychologists are practical people. They translate those things into willingness to provide resources. Sincerity and kindness, what does that actually mean? It might mean that you're a nice guy who's empathic and carries on conversations with a woman and appears to be honestly interested in what she does and how she feels. I think that's true. I think that's important. I think that goes back to compatibility. But it also, in addition to that, inevitably seems to contain an element of a willingness to, kind means giving, I think, inevitably. So let me tell you one more story. When I was in my graduate psychology school, I was a relatively poor student. I was in a relationship with a woman who worked at a clothing store, and she bought me some very expensive shoes. I mean, really quite ridiculously expensive shoes. And I was wearing them one night at a cocktail party that she couldn't come to, and I was talking to three of my female colleagues who hadn't noticed me, I think, before at all. But we all had a glass of wine, and the three of them were standing in front of me. Sort of in a little, we were all kind of in a little circle together. And all of a sudden, I realized I'm looking at the tops of their heads. They're all looking down at my shoes. And I had no idea what was going on. It made no sense at all. And they slowly raise their eyes, and now they're all looking directly at me, and they're looking at me differently. I had no idea what was going on. And one of them says, "Nice shoes." And the other two say, "Yeah." And the tone of voice had changed completely. I now understand. You can put number 11 at the bottom of the list. Nice shoes. I think the meaning of it was this. When they noticed my shoes, number one, they seemed to understand how expensive they were. That means I had resources. It means maturity, because everybody else, all the other guys, were wearing tennis shoes or something like that, or boots. As I ticked off Dr. Buss's list of the 10 things that women want, I realized that those shoes might have symbolized all those things. And within 5 or 10 seconds, the looks I was getting from these women were completely transformed. All of a sudden, because of nice shoes, which I get symbolized most of the 10 things, all of a sudden I was in the eligible bachelor category to them. So guys, number one, go out and buy yourself some good shoes. All right. There's an old saying. Men give love for sex, and women give sex for love. Seems cynical. Turns out there's some truth in it. Like a lot of old sayings, there's always some truth in it. the sexual mating patterns of men and women are different because of biology, different to some degree. And the differences generate conflicts. I want to say that men want monogamous marriage more than any other kind of relationship. And this is the important part. There are differences, but we're not different species. We are not just compatible, but we are necessary for each other. Both of these things can be true. We have conflict, and we are absolutely necessary for each other. So that the simple truth is, men want monogamous relationship more than anything else, and men that don't often have problems. And evolutionarily speaking, men want committed monogamous relationship for three reasons that all go down to genetic survival. Number one, genetic survival is best enhanced by a superior mate. And a man that's willing to commit to a monogamous relationship will have a much higher quality of female mate choice than the man who's just running around on Saturday night loose. If I'm in a committed monogamous relationship, I am much more likely to be certain of the paternity of my children. That enhances my genetic survival. If I am raising other men's children, I am genetically a dead end. And perhaps as important as any of this, number three, third reason for men being committed to monogamous marriage, is that it protects the children. If the man is in the home, if the man is present, if the man is actively participating in the rearing of the children always have a better chance of survival than if he's not there. The recent federal statistics on the differential between two-parent households and single-parent households are at this stage of the game utterly undeniable. A father in the home is, all other things being equal, a dramatically superior way to raise children than single parenting. The statistics simply are no longer deniable. Unfortunately, it's not politically correct. Unfortunately, it causes people to feel bad to say things like that. I hold myself out as a scientist. These are the facts. And Galileo said the earth went around the sun and was threatened with torturous death, and he maintained it to the end of his life. The fact that it caused people trouble or threatened violence because of it, he stayed with science, and I'm going to have to stay with science now and say that how we organize our families should depend mostly on the developmental needs of the children, not our political aspirations. And though it's complicated, I think the tendency now is to see evolution and child development as sort of two sides of the same coin. All right. I'll say it again, that if women criticize men's territoriality and aggression, it's in large part because men that weren't that way did not pass on genetics because our Cro-Magnon great-grandmothers wanted us that way. I was raised in the 60s, and I heard critiques from the early feminists about men treating women as sex objects. It's a serious critique, and if it's done, it's not good, obviously. But the simple fact is, since the beginning of humans on this planet, women have used men as success objects. And so the privileging of resources and all of the variations on that theme seem to open women to the same critique that women have been critiquing men for. Just a variation on that theme. Evolutionary psychology, if it does nothing else, will make both genders a little more humble, I think. Okay, let's go back to what men want. This is going to be a short part of the discussion because the complexity of the female's decision is now obvious. She's got to pick a man who is likely to be there for a long period of time, is capable of adapting to a variety of environments, is willing to work hard to the point of death almost, literally defending the territory and the children. And how do you predict that? You can't predict the future. You can't read someone's mind. You don't know. So all of these things that women want, all of them at the end of the day are predictors of future status or predictors of future behavior that will lead directly to an enhanced genetic survival. All right, what do men want? In order for men to survive genetically, they first have to pick women who can mate, who can breed, who can raise, who can have children. So men's first priority is fertility. The three things men want: youth, beauty, and fertility. And the simple truth is, one and two are the same thing. In our culture, the idea of beauty, and I'm going to suggest universally, worldwide, without exception, beauty is the same everywhere. Beauty are just the indicators, the biological indicators of fertility. You can dress it up, you can put different colored paint on it, you can create variations on the theme, but at the end of the day, across the board, all over the world, men want the same things, want the same thing, and that's fertility, and it's indicated by the presence, or not, of beauty. Some specific things. Maybe this phrase, beauty equals fertility. The priorities for most men: youth, clear skin, full lips, small lower jaw, symmetrical features, white teeth, absence of sores, lesions, small ratio of hip to waist. Researchers actually measured female hip to waist ratio. So if the hips are 100, the waist is 70. So the classic, fairly normal hourglass female figure. It turns out that's what men want everywhere all the time. We don't want obese women, and we don't want little skinny women. Why? Why is it that men who in these researchers always, virtually always, pick a woman who's really close to a 0.70 hip to waist ratio? It turns out medically that is the body shape most likely to be fertile. Skinnier than that, heavier than that, equals less fertility. And there's something about human male evolution that has developed a predisposition to the kind of body most likely to be fertile. It's not culture. It's not Madison Avenue. It's not advertising agencies. It's not commercials on television. It's literally a biological, hardwired predisposition that goes directly to the question of fertility. So, youth and beauty, same thing. Fertility. What about number three, fidelity? This is the other thing men want primarily. They want a woman that's loyal. They want a woman who will not cheat on him and will not, therefore, endanger his genetic survival. And that appears to be it. In all of Dr. Buss's researches, the idea here is that if a man has those two things, fertility and fidelity, that most of the time men will be mostly happy. There's something to that. This is where his research might be open to some objections. Personally, I think a man wants someone intelligent, about as intelligent as himself, maybe even a little better, inspiring him. I'm not sure that's true across the board, but it seems like it to me. Compatibility, same interests. I mean, if you like football and your wife hates football, you've got some problems and conflicts that generate conflicts, perhaps unnecessarily, if you'd pick someone more compatible. So some of the things that women want seem like they have parallel desires in the male. But the research suggests that these are the two main ones, and they're simple relative to the complex woman's calculation. Again, these desires are universal, inborn, not learned, not arbitrary, and not controlled by culture. This is a direct attack on the social constructivists who think that if we just educate men differently, then they'll stop being pigs. Turns out, not going to happen. That this is what men want at the biological level, and it's going to be virtually impossible to change unless you can change the nature of our very species. This can be managed. The problems with it can be managed. But if you think you can change human nature, like most utopians, you end up crashing against the rocks of human nature. You can't fool Mother Nature, they used to say, and perhaps you can't fool Father Nature either. What happens if men and women become wealthy and rich and powerful? Does this change things? And Buss's research, and he actually researched this, says no. We just want more of what we wanted before. We want more beauty. We want more fertility. We want lots of things, but they all come down to the same. We just want more. The type of desire men and women have, and women as well. Women want all the same things. They just want more of them. The achieving of your desires does not appear to significantly change the quality of the mate that you search out. That's fascinating to me. Let's talk about three or four sort of side issues that I think lend weight to this way of thinking. Number one, what is the effect of pornography on all of this? and I want to be careful here. I don't want to come at pornography from a feminist standpoint. I don't want to come at it from a legal standpoint. I definitely don't want to come at it from a moral standpoint. I want to put those perspectives aside for just a minute. I only want to talk about the effect of pornography on relationships. I want to come at it from a psychological, emotional, perhaps evolutionary perspective. The one thing that seems clear about the effect of pornography is this. It is relationship acid. It destroys a man's ability to stay in a healthy relationship. And it makes perfect sense if you think about it. And it's not an accident that virtually all pornography is viewed by men, created for men, and women very rarely engage in watching pornography, especially the more hardcore things. Occasionally, there's some stats on it, but an insignificant amount. It's virtually all designed toward men. Why is that? Because of evolutionary psychology. We are designed as men to focus on sexuality. We had to think about it from the perspective of our tribal culture within which we as individuals evolved. How many beautiful women did our Cro-Magnon male ancestors see in a lifetime? A handful, maybe a handful. And so anytime our Cro-Magnon ancestor males saw a potentially attractive, fertile, healthy female, wow, it was genetically necessary to be able to focus. Men that didn't focus that way died out. Men that were focused on beauty, men that were focused on sexuality, were the ones that were more likely to pass on that variation, which was inheritable, which obviously provides a selective advantage, in that those were the ones who got to mate. And so there we are today, women carrying around the uterus and the ability to have children and secure their genetic survival don't have to be in such a big hurry, don't have to create artificial mating potentials. Men, on the other hand, have a much more intense and urgent need to focus on fertility and beauty. And pornography allows us a technology that artificially evokes in us a biologically based predisposition to focus, which was an adaptive advantage to our ancestors, but is destroying our minds now. I've said to students and patients who I've worked